Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1013, Fascism and the Politics of Immigration. This is being recorded on July 3rd of the year 2018. Of course, in recent weeks, the focus on immigration and immigrants, a major feature of the global political landscape in recent years, has intensified with the discussion the coverage of the forced separation of immigrant children at the U.S. border from their parents. What we're going to do in this program is not to examine that, but rather to examine how the politics of immigration and has been incorporated into and has fed the ideology of fascism. Simply in passing, I want to make it clear that although I am sympathetic to the position, for example, of the Dreamers, and I am sympathetic to the position of the refugees who are having their kids taken away from them, many of those refugees fleeing conditions that were created by American counterinsurgency wars or American-assisted counterinsurgency wars in Latin America during the 1980s. I think that it is a mistake on the part of the, quote, progressive, unquote, political forces to focus as much attention and energy on that as they have. 69% of registered voters in the U.S. are non-Hispanic whites. The vast majority of those are heterosexual and were born in the U.S. I think that the Democratic Party and the, quote, progressive, unquote, political sector are, through the best of intentions, playing into the hands of the forces of reaction. There's some 800,000 Dreamers. That's a relatively small number of people. I don't know the precise number of children that have been separated from their parents, but it is much smaller, several thousand, compared to the vast numbers of people who are going to be separated from their parents and or children by death or serious illness through the many programs that are being implemented by the Trump administration. That is very small indeed. However, what I think is very large indeed is the importance of understanding how anti-immigrant sentiment feeds into and is incorporated into the ideology of fascism. It in and of itself, that is to say anti-immigrant sentiment and xenophobia, combines with and has combined with other political and ideological elements to help to concretize a fascist ideological constellation. We're going to begin with an excerpt from For the Record program number 838 from March of 2015. We are going to be discussing things that took place in the immediate aftermath of World War I. My guest in that interview was Peter Lavenda, the author of the book The Hitler Legacy. We are then going to return to discussion with Peter Lavenda from September of 2015. So from For the Record 838 from late March of 2015, here is Peter Lavenda.
Well, certainly. I mean, the effect of all this sudden European immigration, which was taking place in some cases as a result of World War I, in some cases prior to the war, had the effect of dislocating large segments of American society. You had Irish and Italian immigration, which was largely Roman Catholic immigration to the United States, and there was a strong white Anglo-Saxon movement, of course, the Ku Klux Klan being the most obvious element of it, and as we all know, I believe, the Klan was extremely powerful in this period, in the years just before, leading up to World War I and just after. You had a very strong white nationalist movement that was white, Anglo-Saxon, and Protestant. The influx of Catholic immigration was a threat to the Klan. It was a threat to the hegemony, you might say, of the white Anglo-Saxon infrastructure. So they saw Catholic immigration as being extremely dangerous and upsetting the apple cart. But as they were fighting against Catholic immigration, then suddenly in the 1920s, you had a large influx, a beginning of Jewish immigration to the United States, which, of course, ramped up considerably by the 1930s. So when you had Jewish immigration coming in, this was a threat to both the Catholics and the Protestants. So suddenly you had an uneasy alliance being formed between Christian Catholics and Christian Protestants against the non-Christian Jewish influx. The broadsides that were being printed at the time, the flyers that were being printed, show that there was this concept that was held very strongly that the Jews who were coming in were being assisted by Jews who were already in the United States, who owned businesses, who owned banks, according to the conspiracy theory. They owned corporations. And what they were doing was firing non-Jewish personnel from their offices, from their banks, from their stores, and hiring the recent Jewish immigrants. This was a kind of blood libel, you might say, for the 20th century that was being circulated in the United States, that instead of the Jewish people sacrificing Christian babies, they were instead sacrificing Christian jobs. So you had this idea that communism, as we go along into the war, World War I and the aftermath, that communism was a Jewish creation. Karl Marx, after all, was Jewish. And one of the battle cries of the Nazis and the others concerned the fact that communism was synonymous with Judaism, with being Jewish. And if you were anti-Semitic, then you were obviously anti-communist as well. There was this pairing of the two ideas of communism and Judaism, which is only valid insofar that Karl Marx was Jewish. However, Karl Marx was most famously what you might call a self-hating Jew. His famous article on Die Judenfrage, the Jewish question, was a vicious attack on Jewish banks, on Jewish institutions, and even on the idea of human rights. Karl Marx saw human rights as a quote-unquote Jewish invention, that the Jews had invented this idea of human rights to protect themselves, that it was strictly a selfish creation. So Karl Marx was not promoting Zionism, but by any means he was not promoting Judaism. He was actually against all of that, and he wanted, you know, basically what he claimed, a workers' paradise, something that would overthrow capitalism completely. And he saw the Jews as being the ultimate capitalists. So there's a, you know, there's a disconnect between what Marx had actually written and what people thought about Marx and Marxism and communism. They believed this was a Jewish conspiracy. So communism was a Jewish conspiracy, according to the story. So the Tsarist monarchy in Russia fell because it was as a result of a Jewish conspiracy. The Tsar was murdered in his family because of a Jewish conspiracy. So on and so forth. So suddenly you had one of the largest countries in the world, Russia, had become overnight a communist nation and was consolidating its power all the way into Asia, was forming relationships with the Middle East, the Central Asian countries, trying to form this huge block of an atheistic type of social and economic program. This scared everyone to death in the United States. Suddenly they saw communists everywhere. They saw Jews and communists everywhere. They were being threatened by all of this. And so you had the rise of very vocal opponents of this in some of the most unlikely places. You had, of course, Father Coughlin, the Roman Catholic priest, a radio personality who was on constantly railing against communism and the influx of Jewish ideas into the United States. You had, of course, we all know about Charles Lindbergh. We know about Henry Ford. All of this pushback from financiers, people who had a lot of money at stake, who saw communism as being a threat to them, especially because of the rise of the labor unions in the United States. These seemed to be socialist or communist-inspired organizations, giving power to the workers, and this was a major threat to the industrial giants in the United States, just as it was to the industrial giants in Germany and in the rest of Europe. Hitler would never have come to power had it not been for the tremendous financial backing he got from corporate Germany as well as corporate America. So communism, Judaism, all of this was wrapped into this one big banner of the sort of black flag of evil that was threatening the entire world, and it galvanized the opposition in the United States.
There is another ideological flavor, to coin a term, that was mixed into this particular recipe. You write in the Hitler Legacy of the effect of Charles Darwin's theories on evolution, and how those came to be seen by social thinkers, both within the Nazi movement per se in Germany, and also ideological fellow travelers, so to speak, in the United Kingdom and in the U.S. How does Darwin and the concept of eugenics fit into this scenario?
Well, eugenics actually gave the scientific, quote-unquote scientific, vindication or justification for what was really an ideological conflict. Darwin, as we all know, became famous for suggesting that there was such a thing as evolution. And what was taken from evolution and survival of the fittest and all of these concepts that were being bandied about without anyone actually doing the reading was the idea that there were races that were more further evolved along the evolutionary path than others. This was a major component not only of scientific thinking of that time in the United States as well as in Europe. And remember, Germany, at the time that this was all being developed, was at the forefront of science and learning. Germany was the beacon for scientific theory, for scientific method. People sort of slavishly followed what was happening in Germany. So you had this idea that not only were races that could be divided in terms of their position on the evolutionary path, shall we say, but there was a spiritual aspect to Darwinism as well. And this is what the Nazi Party in particular latched on to. And it kind of infected other eugenics and racial movements in other parts of the world. And this was something represented by Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, who created the Theosophical Society and who wrote Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine, very influential works at the time in the late 19th century. She posited the idea that certain races were perhaps more spiritually advanced than others as well, and that humanity was proceeding along an evolutionary path. They were becoming more and more spiritually aware, more spiritually powerful. But this got mixed in with some of the other racial theories of the day, so that it was assumed that those races that were not spiritually advanced were the same as the races that were not advanced along the evolutionary path. That meant to the eugenicists that if evolution was in fact true, scientifically speaking, then it stood to reason that since we had discovered this fact of evolution, we could interfere with it. We could get involved in evolution. We could tinker with the process and maybe speed up the evolutionary process to the point where the new man, quote unquote, would make itself manifest. And in order to tinker with the system, we had to get rid of those parts of the evolutionary pack that were considered to be deleterious to the creation of this new man, the creation of the next step in evolution. And of course, that opened the door to a lot of ideas about racism, about getting rid of those who were mentally infirm, physically infirm. Again, what is the baseline for this? What measurement, what metric are we going to use to determine what is or what is not mentally undesirable, physically undesirable? And once we started with that, we had the German concept of the useless eaters, those who contributed nothing to the human race from the point of view of the Germans. Therefore, the old people could also be killed, and they were. The mentally retarded, the physically infirm in other ways, all of these people were not contributing to society. They were holding back the progress of the race, holding back evolution. They had to be first sterilized, in many cases, very horribly sterilized, forcibly sterilized, so they could not reproduce. And then the next step after that was their destruction. So this idea was championed in the United States as well. We had many people who were very strong advocates of eugenics, which was this race science of cleaning up the race, getting rid of people who were not contributing towards the racial ideal that we had for ourselves. So we had laws against people having certain disabilities or certain mental or physical handicaps marrying and producing children. There was forced sterilization of the mentally retarded. We had operations like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment that went on for decades, in which we basically were providing a kind of genocidal experiment against black men in the South. We had all sorts of rules against who could or could not have children. The races could not mix. Black people and white people were forbidden to marry in many states. White people and Filipinos, for some reason, in several states, were that was off the books. You could not marry. You could not marry Asians. So this kind of idea that we had to keep the white race pure above all else was extremely important. And this, of course, eventually led to the Holocaust as we know it, because the Jews were considered to be spiritually inferior. They had created communism. They had created socialism. They were responsible for the Russian Revolution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they go back to the old story, they were the Christ killers, according to the theory. So all of this meant that the Jewish people were doomed to extinction. And after the Jews, of course, the Slavs, black people, African Americans, Africans in general, Asians, et cetera, et cetera.
In 1929, of course, the stock market collapsed. The speculative boom of the 1920s ended. The Great Depression began. And after a few years of futility by Herbert Hoover and his what is now known as austerity, Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to power, of course, and elected in 1932. And he then implemented the New Deal, including many pieces of social legislation that we take for granted today, such as Social Security. How did the elements and the ideal, how were the political elements and the ideological elements that you have already outlined for us affected both by the Great Depression and by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal?
Well, they're of a piece. The Great Depression seemed to be proof that the suspected worldwide conspiracy of Jews and communists against capitalism was actually taking effect. It looked as though this was actually happening. It was happening right in front of us. Poor people were being thrown out on the street. Rich people, in some cases, were losing everything, and it was all due to this massive global conspiracy that was understood to be taking place. The reaction against it was severe. Roosevelt came out and decided to create a lot of social programs. And it was viewed that this was exactly what the communists wanted to have happen. They wanted these social programs put in place. They wanted to move the United States closer and closer to a communist or socialist ideal. And instead of seeing Roosevelt's programs as being what was going to save American capitalism from certain defeat, they saw it instead as a step closer towards a communist tyranny. And newspaper articles, broadsides, flyers published at the time called Franklin Roosevelt a crypto-Jew or a Jew. They blamed him. They said he was hiring Jews for his cabinet. He was putting Jews in positions of prominence and importance in government and in industry. They saw Roosevelt as a communist, and they saw him as a dictator. They called him basically all the names that are being directed towards Obama today, if I could just make that comparison, because it stood out to me. When I started reading the articles that were being printed in the 1930s in the United States, it seemed all you had to do was change a few words and you had pretty much the same reaction. Roosevelt was considered a dictator. He was considered a socialist, a communist, and a Jew. Basically everything that you could think of to frighten a middle-class white American male was put into these descriptions. These were all the code words for the fact that they felt that Roosevelt was handing the country over to the communists. So this was a major, major problem, and you had people on the extreme right in the United States who saw this as being true. You had people like Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh and some of the others who were dead set against the New Deal. They thought this was a really bad idea. The fact that there were a lot of poor people out of work and homeless was not really their problem. The American dream, of course, that everyone should work hard and become rich on their own by their own efforts, and to have the government bail them out was considered very wrong, wrong-headed, and was a step in the direction of the Soviet Union. So all of this was taking place in the 1930s. Roosevelt was seen as a major opponent of all things American. He was considered to be an anti-American president, and there were numerous attempts on his life. There were numerous assassination attempts, including some by Nazis. Actually, in the United States, the Nazi plots that were revealed later, there were all kinds of attempts on his life, and he had to undergo a great deal of opposition, some of it open from the extreme right and some of it sort of under masquerade from moderates on the Republican Party. But there was still this idea that Roosevelt did not speak for Americans. He was representing a kind of internationalist idea of what America was, and that was considered to be a real problem. And he was mightily opposed by the right.
Before I'd like to further explore some of the nomenclature of the fifth column in the U.S. Before doing that, though, a point that you made that I think would be worth underscoring here, and that is that an element of reactionary politics that one sees, just as there is a similarity, and I think you're spot on with your comparison of the baiting of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a Jew or a Marxist. In fact, he was neither. Is very similar to the way that Obama has been baited as a Muslim and a socialist. And both men were therefore seen as traitors because of that. You also noted that both today and in the 1930s, the forces of political reaction were motivated to an extent by an illusion of a simpler time, a happier time to which we could return, sort of a political atavism. I wonder if you would develop that for us.
It is a hallmark, I think, of a certain type of political idea, a kind of, we may call it fascism or nationalism, that says in some time in the past, the world was paradise. In illo tempora, as they call it in anthropology and in history of religion circles, in that time, in that era, the golden age. And I think there was a lot of that, this kind of mystification of the past, of a glorious past, which of course we all know never really existed, but it's the idea that there was a paradise before there were waves of Italian immigration, Irish immigration, Jewish immigration, before there was communism, before the Soviet, before Russia fell to the Soviet Bolshevik revolution. So there was this idea that before all these things happened, everything was just fine. Everything was great. Of course, it was hideous for many people in those countries. It was hideous in the United States for people who were black, for people who were not wealthy, people who didn't have jobs, people who were on the outs anyway. Their lifestyle was horrible. It was the same in Europe. It was the same, certainly, in Russia, where the peasants had suffered a great deal under the Tsars. So you had this idea that, you know, if we just would roll back the clock, we could go back to a happier, nicer, freer time when everyone was happy and, you know, there were strawberries and cream for everyone. Of course, that wasn't so, but this is something that is a motivating factor, not only in those days, not only in the 1930s, but it is today as well. You find a lot of people longing for a time, probably in the 1950s, where everything seemed to be fine, everything seemed to be okay. It was the rise of the middle class in the 1950s, a middle class that really didn't exist until World War II in any great numbers. And suddenly there was a middle class, and now the middle class is threatened again. So you have a large segment of the population thinking it would be nice to go back to that time. But you can't go back to that time without going back to everything in that time and without giving up everything you've accomplished in this time. But people who idealize that era don't understand it. They haven't really remembered what was really going on in those days. And they have a rosy view where all of the negativity was suppressed and repressed, and they just think of things, you know, as being just sweet and wonderful. And of course it wasn't so. The Nazi Party grew on the basis of this idea. I mean, it was a longing for that time, that idyllic time when it was before the Industrial Revolution. The Nazis hated the Industrial Revolution. They hated the cities. They longed to go back to the countryside. They longed to be peasants and farmers again. They wanted their young people to go out and to wander the fields and to get in touch with nature. It was a kind of green movement, you might say, at that time. There was this idea that, you know, what happened, we've gone astray. We've let the Jews into the world, into our country, and they've manipulated everything and ruined everything. We've let international corporations get involved in our lives and in our country, and they've ruined everything, et cetera, et cetera. They wanted to go back to a time even before Christianity. They wanted to go to a time when the Teutonic and the Nordic gods were all that they knew, a time that was considered to be full of manliness and glory and warfare, for the sake and for the glory of warfare. So these are romantic ideas based on myths that have very little relationship to what actually happened. But because people were so dissatisfied with their present life, they were incapable of envisioning a future that they could improve. They were incapable of thinking that maybe they could take what they had today and make a better tomorrow. Instead, it was much easier to look backwards and to sigh and to think, wouldn't it be better if we could go back to the past?
That again from For the Record 838 from late March of 2015. I did a total of 10 interviews with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy. Then in September of that year, Peter joined us once again for the Record 64. At this point, Donald Trump was leading. This is, again, September of 2015. Donald Trump was leading the field of presumptive potential Republican presidential candidates. Of course, eventually he won the primary and, quote, won, unquote, no, the quotes, the election itself. One of the things that we are talking about in this interview, recapping much of what we spoke about in For the Record 838, is how Trump has mobilized the fear of immigration and basically welded it onto his ideology. Beyond that, in Europe, at that point in time, late 2015, and to this day, anti-immigrant sentiment has been a huge, huge mobilizing factor in helping to concretize what are being euphemized as, quote, populist, unquote, forces. Read fascists throughout Europe, including places like Hungary and Poland in particular, where people have almost no experience with immigrants from Muslim countries, be they Syria or wherever. So again, in September 2015 and in For the Record 864, we rejoined Pete Lavenda and further developed the politics of immigration as they relate to fascism. However, the one thing that I would have done differently is to conclude, For the Record 847, our 10th interview, with what we're going to be beginning this talk with. And I think in a way, it is perhaps appropriate that we're doing this now, because the importance of what I would like to talk about, I think, is even more dramatic and in even higher political relief, so to speak, than it was in last spring. On page 315 of the Hitler Legacy, right at the end of the book, you write as follows. Xenophobia is at an all-time high in Europe and increasingly in America. As the political life of every country becomes more and more polarized between right and left, the men of Odessa can only laugh at our discomfort. When one looks at the news as we speak on September 20th of 2015, refugees from the Middle East are overwhelming or certainly taxing the infrastructure of European countries and in many ways overwhelming the political establishment's ability to deal with that. And at the same time, here in the U.S., we have Donald Trump and other GOP candidates trying to one-up each other with their anti-immigrant proposals, ranging from building a wall across the southern United States. One of the candidates, that may have been Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio, said we should build a wall with Canada, too. So anti-immigrant sentiment, xenophobia are dominating much of the political agenda and discussion. Peter, how do you see this as being part of the Hitler legacy?
Well, it certainly resonates with me on that level. I look back at American history, and we've had waves of immigrants coming in at various times. We had, you know, from the Irish potato famine, we had a great deal of Irish people coming here. They were considered less than human. I remember reading about the signs that said, "No Irish need apply." We had waves of Italian immigrants, and people were afraid they were going to bring Roman Catholicism with them in a negative way, and allegiance to the Pope in Rome. That was considered extremely dangerous, almost the way we're looking at Islam today. Then we had waves of Jewish immigrants in the 1920s and 1930s, and the hysteria that was developed among the extreme right in the United States over this form of immigration was unbelievable. The stories were that Jewish store owners would fire their non-Jewish employees so they could hire Jewish immigrants to replace them. The idea that Americans were losing their jobs to immigrants is a very old meme that we've been living with in our country for a very long time. So now we have this other situation, this wave of new immigrants, which we assume exists. We actually, immigration, net immigration from Mexico, as all the statistics show, has declined in recent years. And even we now have a president, President Obama, who has deported more people probably than any political Republican candidate or previous president. So we're looking at a very skewed form of reality, almost a fantasy about immigration, which is based upon this fear of the other. We had Trump's very famous remarks concerning Islam going back almost 10 years now. We have, you know, people still claiming, I mean, an outlandish percentage of Republicans, more than 40%, believing that Obama is actually a Muslim. As if, number one, that's a bad thing, which no one's proven to me that it's a bad thing, but also using it as a kind of pejorative to say that Obama is a foreigner, he's a stranger, he's destroying the country, a lot of the same stuff they directed towards President Roosevelt in the 1930s. Until World War II broke out. So we're looking at a legacy of this kind of xenophobia, this fear of the other, fear of strangers, fear of non-traditional American people, whatever they are today. I'm not sure what that demographic would be. But it's the people that are supporting populist candidates like Donald Trump, who are pushing a very sort of neo-fascist agenda, and that maybe sounds extreme to some people, but I've watched a lot of the speeches of Trump. I've been desperate to find details about his policies on anything. All I find is a general attitude of the country is falling apart, we have to make it great, we have to keep out the extraneous elements, et cetera, et cetera. And his remarks about Mexicans are very telling. Not just the famous remark in which, you know, Mexican immigrants are all criminals and rapists, but the remark that, you know, some of my best friends are Mexicans and, you know, I have thousands of them working for me, so I have nothing against them, which is pretty much like a plantation owner saying he's got nothing against Africans, they make great slaves. So I don't really understand how we in the 21st century can still support this type of rhetoric, but on the other hand, I can. There's a kind of minority in this country that feels it's being threatened, but we've gone through this so many times before, we just don't remember it. We've gone through this with Irish immigration, Italians, Jewish immigration, Eastern European immigrants. My grandparents, my father's side, came from Eastern Europe. You know, they worked in coal mines. I mean, they worked later in the steel mills in this country. But they were discriminated against, you know. They were all called honkies. Basically, it's a term that eventually came used for all white people, but in those days referred to people from Hungary. My grandparents didn't come from Hungary, but they did come from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They were Slovaks. So, you know, there's this, we have a tradition in this country of waves of immigration coming in and a lot of resistance against it. People want to see the status quo. And the idea that we hear from these sort of right-wing demagogues that they want to take their country back is very disturbing to me. Back to where? Back to what? You know, back to the days of slavery? Back to the days when women didn't have the vote? Back to the days when people were not assured of a grade school education? I'm not sure what back means in this case. I'm being disingenuous here. I mean, I know what back means as far as they're concerned. It means back to when the country was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Peter, in the Hitler legacy, you've noted that the desire to return to a mythically idealized past was fundamental to the fascist viewpoint.
Yes. And I mean, Hitler's idea was that we want to leave the cities. The cities were evil. Go back to the countryside, embrace a kind of Nordic Teutonic paganism. Himmler refined this to a greater extent in saying we have to get rid of Christianity altogether because Christianity is really a Jewish sect. And it's a sect of weakness and of compassion and mercy, and that's alien to the German soul. So we have to get back to, in illo tempora, as they say in scholastic circles, back in those times, back to those days, which was a golden age. And there never was such a golden age, but there is still this idea that things were better before the fall from grace, before they were kicked out of paradise. So it's this is a hallmark of fascism. It's a hallmark of an extreme form of nationalism. And the problem that I have, you know, nationalism may be a good thing in some cases, that you're patriotic, you want to support your country, you want to idealize your country, perhaps. That's a natural tendency of a lot of people to do. I'm a native New Yorker, so I sometimes idealize New York City. I understand reaction. However, what happened with fascism and what happened with, especially with Nazism, is that nationalism became synonymous with racism. You couldn't be a German nationalist if you were Jewish, no matter what kind of German nationalistic pride you felt, no matter how much of a German you felt. If you were Jewish, you were not part of the quote-unquote nation. The nation became this fantasy image, this virtual reality that you could not become part of by virtue of the fact that ethnically or racially, your origins were not in Germany. So that's nationalism taken to an extreme. And now we're confronting the same kind of idea here with this political cycle, that there is a kind of nationalism. You know, we want our country back to the way it was before there were immigrants, you know, before there were all of these immigrants of color coming in, which is really what people are arguing about, really what they're upset about, is the colorized version of the immigrant situation that we're facing today. And we're not really even facing it. It's not as much of a problem today as it was even 10 years ago, but it's become, you know, this piñata that the Republican Party wants to kick around. And no one is really fighting them on this issue. If you say it's racism, then of course you're being hysterical and you're being extreme. And it's not to do with racism at all. It's about crime, or it's about a dozen other things. So it's yes, it is part of the Hitler legacy. It's part of that fascism. It's part of this idea that we're going to foment this discord in the United States between, you know, the nativist Americans and everybody else. We have to scapegoat. We have to stereotype. Trump has been doing that with China, with Japan, with Mexico. He's been doing that with countries that he claims are taking away our jobs or destroying us, when actually these countries are in very bad shape themselves. It's just a fantasy virtual reality that he's created and that other people like him have created. And it's a nice place for, you know, some people to live in, because it, you know, it supports their prejudices, it supports their biases, their inaccurate understanding of history.
In Europe as well. By the way, as I develop this, one of the things that I have been finding fascinating as well as insidious is the subtle change in language. We're being told that, quote, populist, unquote, parties in Europe, such as the Front National in France, the Sweden Democrats, and others, are populist parties. And they're basically fascist. They are extreme right-wing parties, and they are minting some very valuable political currency on that same dynamic, anti-immigrant. I think if Hitler came to life today, the way our political lexicon would refer to him as the German paleoconservative or paleoconservative Adolf Hitler, whom critics accuse of pursuing an ultra-nationalist agenda. And they wouldn't say, yeah, the Nazi leader Adolf Hitler.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Europe as well is dealing with a huge influx of humanity from the Middle East, people fleeing the brutal wars and the depredations of ISIS. And before commenting on that, Peter, I just wanted to note, before you comment on that, Another interesting change of language. They're not being referred to as refugees in our popular media, but, quote, migrants, unquote, as though these were some sort of, you know, shiftless, roving parasites of some kind. I mean, that's not necessarily what they say, but they are refugees in the truest sense of the word. They are fleeing for their lives and the lives of their families, and yet they're not called refugees, but, quote, migrants, unquote. And as we are speaking, the European, the EU infrastructure, politically and economically, is wrestling with what is going to happen. I wonder if you would give us your thoughts about that.
Well, I remember, I'm old enough to remember, the 1950s, the 1960s, there was a situation in Europe where there were millions of people who were displaced from their homes because of World War II. They were Eastern Europeans, largely, or people from the Baltic countries, or people from Western Europe, whose homes had been bombed and destroyed during the war. And they were pejoratively referred to as DPs, which meant displaced persons, but they were never referred to as migrants. They were refugees. And it was a terrible refugee problem that existed in Europe at that time. We took, in the United States, many of these refugees in, and other parts of the world did as well. And it was a refugee crisis. Nobody would have dared refer to them as migrants. That would have been obscene, you know. And in the case of people fleeing Syria right now, to refer to them as migrants is equally obscene. These people are refugees. They're fleeing for their lives. And if anyone has seen any of the film footage of Syrian cities, just film footage taken in the last couple of weeks, you would be appalled at what you're looking at. You're looking at something that makes Dresden during the war look like a Disney theme park. We're talking about terrible devastation. The human loss is incredible. So you have people fleeing for their lives, and to refer to them as migrants is just a way of devaluing and taking the energy out of what's really going on, trying to turn it into some kind of social experiment when people are actually fleeing for their lives. So yes, the abuse of language, of course, is part of this process. Yes, you know, you would refer these days to Hitler as a populist leader, you know, or an ultra-nationalist or something like that. And yet if we look at the existing populist leaders in Europe right now, they're all of that same mode. You mentioned the Front in France, Marie Le Pen, who's running that one. You're talking about the Swedish Democrats, who've gained a lot of seats in the Swedish parliament. You're talking about groups in Belgium, Denmark, Finland, everywhere, the Netherlands, who are getting stronger and stronger. And it's based upon this idea of anti-immigration, which is, you know, not that removed from how Hitler described, you know, Jews in Mein Kampf, and how he scapegoated entire peoples that way as being the problem, as being the reason they lost World War I. So you're looking at a demonization of the other, which is part of our inheritance from that poisonous ideology. When does it happen that we, the United States, is hesitant to bring refugees who are fleeing for their lives into the United States, when we've already always opened our doors to people who are fleeing persecution? In this case, we don't want to. Obama's in a very dangerous situation with this, because of the, I mean, when 40% of the opposing party thinks you're a Muslim, if you bring in, you know, a couple of hundred thousand Muslim refugees, you're pretty much going to be crucified by the extreme right as trying to destabilize the United States in some fashion. We have over 350 million people living here. To bring in 500,000 immigrants, people who are fleeing for their lives, doesn't seem like such a big deal. But it would, you know, politically, I think it's almost impossible for him to do it. I don't think his party would let him do it. And yet, this is a very sad time, you know, to be an American, when we should be standing up for this. People are saying, well, you're going to be bringing in terrorists. I have news for you. They've been going and coming, you know, without a problem for decades, all through Europe and all through the United States and every other part of the world. They don't need this as cover in order to come into this country, or to any country for that matter. They've been doing pretty well on their own. So this is not, you know, the issue. We can't keep everybody out because we're afraid, you know, somebody from the Islamic State may get in, even though the Islamic State says that they're sending people in with the refugees That's the Islamic State trying to, again, exert influence over our political systems, over our political reactions, both in Europe and in the United States, by using this idea, this threat. And it keeps the Syrians out of Europe. It keeps the Syrians out of the United States and back to where ISIS can deal with them. If we refuse, if everybody refuses to take these refugees, what is the alternative? They go back to Syria. And what happens there? They either become radicalized or they die. So these are the options we're looking at. And we have to ask ourselves, which is the better political option?
Indeed. And people should remember, as they listen to this rhetoric, one of the major focal points of not only the Hitler legacy, but our 10 interviews done about that book, about weaponized Islam, adopted, actually crafted by the West, and employed by it for decades in numerous scenarios, and that precise weaponized Islam gave rise to the very, quote, terrorists, unquote, that we are talking about today. A small detail, Peter, when we are talking about Europe and the EU and their vocal and political distaste for the, quote, migrants, unquote. I think that's a despicable term, as though they were locusts or something, you know, sort of descending on one place and sucking out the vital energies and then migrating over someplace else. It really is, I think, a profoundly evil, almost psycholinguistic fascism. We're told that the migrants, unquote, are, or at least the political line being peddled by the European neo-fascist parties, is that these migrants, unquote, are going to corrupt the sanctity, so to speak, of the EU, which stands as a civilized citadel in contrast with all of these darkies who are coming over from the Middle East. That, again, from For the Record 864, from September of 2015. Of course, Donald Trump is now president and is galvanizing his base with anti-immigrant sentiment, portraying them as all being members of MS-13 who are flooding into our country to commit crimes and what have you. I don't think it requires a great deal of thought, let alone imagination, to see how the fears that Donald Trump is mobilizing and the fears that are being mobilized by reactionaries, read fascists in Europe, are at one with the sort of xenophobia that helped to propel Hitler, Mussolini, and others into power in the pre-World War II period as well. Recently, Melania Trump, the First Lady, visited a facility in Texas where, I believe it was in Texas, where some immigrant children were being detained, and she wore a jacket that said, "I really don't care, do you?" using the letter U. Many people thought that was insensitive. What we're going to do is to take a look at that phrase, "I don't care," which has a very specific history in the history, I should say, of fascism. An article in the Overland online publication from June 22nd of 2018. This is by Giovanni, G-I-O-V-A-N-N-I, Tiso, T-I-S-O, "A Brief Fascist History of I Don't Care." In this article, Mr. Tiso disclaims any notion that Melania Trump was trying to send a signal with that jacket. Is not necessarily an opinion that I share. I suspect that what she was doing was sending a dog whistle to Trump's base. She is an intelligent woman. Also, incidentally, employed one time by the Wilhelmina Modeling Agency, which at one point was owned by a prominent German industrialist named Dieter Esch, E-S-C-H, who may very well have been part of the Borman Network, about whom I speak so often. Perhaps we'll go into that in a future program. It is not necessarily central here, but it might be relevant. What is relevant, I believe, is what she was saying with that jacket, and I suspect that she was fully conscious of what she was doing and was basically dog-whistling the Trump base. Again, A Brief Fascist History of I Don't Care by Giovanni Tiso from Overland of June 22nd of 2018. Skipping down, the jacket, and that's in brackets, the echoes of which someone ought to have been aware, especially in an administration that includes, to put it mildly, several far-right sympathizers. And also to show that the attitude, the theatrical, quote, not caring, unquote, was an explicit character trait of fascism. Fascism lay its roots in the campaign for Italy's late entry in the First World War, of which Benito Mussolini was one of the leaders. It was at this time that the phrase me ne frego, M-E-N-E-F-R-E-G-O, which at the time was still considered quite vulgar along the lines of the English, I don't give an F blank blank blank, was sung by members of the special force known as Arditi, A-R-D-I-T-I, literally the daring ones, who volunteered for the front to signify that they didn't care if they should lose their lives. The Arditi were disbanded after the war, but many of them volunteered in 1919 for an expedition led by the poet Gabriele D'Annunzio, D'A-N-N-U-N-Z-I-O, to capture the city of Fiume, F-I-U-M-E, Rijeka, R-I-J-E-K-A, in present-day Croatia, and claim it for Italy during the vacuum created by the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. At the time of this occupation, former Arditi also formed the backbone of the original Black Squads during the terror campaign that began in 1919 and culminated with the March on Rome of 1922, which completed fascism's swift rise to power, skipping down. Me ne frego, again in English, I don't care, was the title of one of the most famous songs of the fascist era. Its original version, dating around 1920, hails D'Annunzio and Mussolini as the fathers of the fascist movement, recycling the old war song of the Arditi as the third stanza. Me ne frego, me ne frego, me ne frego il nostro motto, I don't care is our motto. Me ne frego di morire, I don't care if I should die. Per la santa libertà, for our sacred freedom. Later versions removed mentions of D'Annunzio, who faded fairly quickly into the background. In the meantime, Mussolini made the slogan his own and explicitly elevated it to the philosophy of the regime. The proud black shirt motto, I don't care, written on the bandages that cover a wound, isn't just an explicit act of Stoic philosophy or the summary of a political doctrine. It is an education to fighting, and the acceptance of the risks it implies. It's a new Italian lifestyle. This is how the fascist welcomes and loves life while rejecting and regarding suicide as an act of cowardice. This is how the fascist understands life as duty, exaltation, conquest. A life that must be lived highly and fully, both for oneself but especially for others near and far, present and future. The connotations of altruism at the end of the quote are in direct contrast with the meaning taken on by the word me ne freghismo, literally I don't careism, which ever since the regime has meant in common parlance a kind of detached self-reliance or moral autocracy, just as Italy broke with its former allies and charted a stubborn path towards the ruin and devastation of the Second World War, so too the fascist citizen was encouraged to reject the judgment of others and look straight ahead. It should be remembered in this regard that the regime treated ignorance and proclivity to violence as desirable qualities to be rewarded with positions of influence and power. This required a swift redrawing of the old social norms and of the language used to signify the moral worth of individuals. Mene Frego was the perfect slogan for the people in charge of overseeing such a program. 4 years ago, speaking at a First World War commemoration in the small town of Rigipuglia, Pope Francis linked Mene Frego not only with the carnage of the First World War, but also with the horrors of fascism, recognizing its ideological and propaganda value for Mussolini's project. This is the form in which the slogan has survived until the present day, as a linguistic signifier not of generic indifference, but of ideological nostalgia. And because the attempts in Italy and beyond to stem the spread of such signifiers have been comprehensively abandoned, we readily find those words appearing not just on seemingly ubiquitous fascist-era memorabilia, but also on posters. And again, I suspect that Melania Trump, who I believe speaks Italian, knew what she was doing. The jacket she wore, by the way, is made by Zara, which has an interesting history. It's a Spanish company. And in The Guardian of August 27th of 2014, an article by Elena Cresci, C-R-E-S-C-I, Zara removed striped pajamas with yellow star following online outrage. It points out, and the text of the article is excerpted in the written description for the record 1013, which will be available presently. They marketed a children's shirt which bore a yellow star and a strong resemblance to the uniforms that concentration camp inmates wore during World War II. Eventually, when this caught the eye of a number of critics, they withdrew this. It should also be noted that Zara put out a handbag in 2007, which featured swastika designs, and those two eventually were withdrawn. I would note, too, that the New York Times of April 19th of 2017 has an article by Vanessa Friedman, Zara loses its skirt over Pepe the Frog. The company also marketed a skirt featuring Pepe the Frog, although originally not a racist or xenophobic image. It has been adopted by, quote, alt-right people to basically be racist and anti-immigrant. Again, the text of both of these articles is in the description for the record 1013. By way of, I think, highlighting the long-standing ideology of the Republican Party, I really bristle at those people in the so-called progressive sector who continue the refrain, and there's no significant difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. That is not just insane, that is evil. And I hope when whatever dinosaur Trump appoints to succeed Justice Kennedy, and I think Judge Ginsburg will eventually succumb to the trials of the flesh, and Trump will appoint, or perhaps Trump and Mike Pence will appoint a third of the Supreme Court and appoint judges who are young and approved by the Federalist Society, pointing out the type of pro-immigrant program that the Republicans have favored. We've noted in many broadcasts the crusade for freedom that was a covert operation begun in the immediate aftermath of World War II, which not only promoted Central European fascist organizations like the Croatian Ustashi, the Bulgarian National Front, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Ukrainian OUNB, and others, as leaders in the ethnic groups in the U.S., Eastern European ethnic groups. It also recruited them as, quote, fascist freedom fighters working for the CIA in Europe. They were incorporated into the U.S. and the GOP by Richard Nixon, who was appointed to head up this program by his mentor, Alan Dulles, who had been Thomas Dewey's campaign manager in the 1948 election. It was felt that the GOP had to counterbalance the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote, which was seen by the Republicans as having tipped the 48 election against them. In addition to Richard Nixon, who oversaw the program for Alan Dulles, Ronald Reagan was its chief spokesperson. William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's campaign manager in 1980 and became his director of the CIA, oversaw the State Department program that imported these Nazis into the U.S. And ultimately, George Herbert Walker Bush made the Crusade for Freedom Eastern European Fascists a permanent part of the Republican Party. But it should be known that when the program had been put together, the immigration laws were changed. Reading from The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, in 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country, and Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. So never let it be said that the Republicans are anti-immigration. This concludes For the Record program number 1013, Fascism and the Politics of Immigration, being recorded on July 3rd of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.